And I wanted to address the issue of missing persons. In the U.S., the FBI reports over 600,000 people are reported missing every year, and children under 18 account for approximately 35% of those. Some are found, some are not. But I wanted to talk with two people who this issue is near and dear to, Bruce Maitland. He is the founder of Private Investigations for the Missing, and Jordan Scherer, who is a prominent local private investigator and owner of RA, Private Investigation and Security, who frequently is called upon to investigate missing persons case. Bruce and Jordan, thank you so much for joining us. Hi.
Thank you for having me.
So, Bruce,
yeah, thank you for having me.
Hi. I don't want to dwell on this too much, but I you come from a place where you had this tragedy in your life with your daughter, Brianna. In 2004, your 17-year-old daughter went missing. Can you just tell us briefly what happened and how you came up with the idea to start this organization that you have run for all these years?
Yeah, very briefly, my daughter, Brianna, was working in a upscale ski lodge or whatever, in Vermont, and she had been working in the kitchen, and she had finished work around 11 o'clock. Co-workers seen her drive away, and a mile from there, her car was found bashed into an abandoned building. And at that point, you know, there was some struggle had taken place. There was evidence of struggle. But at that point, we really don't know what happened.
So, Bruce, you started this organization, which is Private Investigations for the Missing. Tell me what your organization does and how it does it.
Well, we're a group of us here. There's about 25 all volunteers. And interacting with other families and different people that have missing loved ones and seeing what they went through with private investigators and not being able to afford it. It just kind of really laid on my heart to be able to, if there was an organization out there who could hire a qualified private investigator to look into their loved one's missing case. You know, and I found out that organization did not exist. As far as I know, we are the only organization that actually put boots on the ground. The organization is all volunteers. Any funding we raise goes toward the private investigators and database fees and some things like that. So about 98% of the money goes directly into the helping the families. And, you know, it's just something that was laid on my heart, and we continue to help everybody that we can, and we exist all on small donations.
So I'm just going to say the name again, Private Investigations for the Missing. It'll be on the WGN website. What a worthy cause, a very, very worthy cause, because I would imagine that some of these things cost a lot of money. And if the police are not following up or you think they need to follow up more, you can't really force that issue. So you may have to go the private route, which is why I want to talk to Jordan about this. You have been involved in missing persons cases. Do you think generally that the police do a good job? I mean, I know it goes from case to case and police officer to police officer.
Yeah. That's a large answer. I would say generally speaking, if I'm going to walk an objective answer here, I think when the initial onset of the investigation, I can definitely say that they do a very good job of cell phone tracking and ping. CSLI is a formal term. They're excellent at that, and I can't deny that. As well as the baseline interviewing. Take an example: this person was seen at this diner with this person. Follow up with that diner with said person, and go from there. I would think that there's a little bit of criticism that I could offer, as haven't been shy about on your show before with the collection of video evidence. I think that is sorely. Sorely lacking.
And when you say that, Jordan, what do you mean exactly, the gathering of video?
Yep. So I mean storefronts, commercial businesses, I mean Ring doorbell cameras and the surrounding block radius, all of the above. It's an area that's very, very sorely lacking. And I know that from experience time and time again. Beyond that, I would say victimology interviewing. So just going that extra mile, and some of that is resources, and I can empathize with that to a degree. But if I manage to do it pro bono, then, you know, I have to call upon public officials to do the same. And going that extra mile and interviewing sisters, cousins, brothers, aunts, et cetera, getting to know you're missing. That's victimology 101, is who am I looking for? Who is this person? You have to know who you're looking for inside and out. You're going to find where they are. So
let's take this a little bit one by one. You get hired to find a missing person. First, let me just ask, is it a whole different strategy when you're talking about a child versus an adult, and how so?
Sure. No, of course. Well, I mean, first of all, with juveniles, we tend not to get involved because we tend to give that benefit of the doubt that there's going to be a higher priority that law enforcement is going to, you know, recover this missing juvenile. So especially early on, especially we get a lot of calls. People can, you know, check me on this. One of my reviews is about this. I turned an individual away because I talked them through every step of the process. And I was able to gather, okay, law enforcement is talking to the right people. They're going about this the right way. I see no flaws in this investigation. We're inside the 2-week marker. Just hold your breath. They're going to find your daughter. And they did. Okay. But there is a one case example. Obviously I won't say her names, of a teenager who was missing, and we knew through a card that was entrusted in him by his parents that he had purchased a bus ticket, a Greyhound ticket, and he had bought a sandwich at a restaurant about 5 blocks away before he subsequently entered the bus. Neither Greyhound nor that restaurant video footage was gathered. So there we go back to that. That was a huge issue. By the grace of God, this individual turned himself in at a police station a couple weeks later, just from being exhausted, being on the run. But it could have went the other way. So that's the difference there. I will say too is think in terms of you're extrapolating on the work environment with an adult. Liken that to school. So that's a difference right there. You got to expand out. Cast your net a little bit wider with the school as opposed to the work environment. That'd be some similarities there.
So is it true that there's a new law in Illinois that says that you cannot have a mandatory 24-hour waiting period when a missing person when the police will take the missing person's report? Is that a new law?
Very, very much true.
And is that going to help, do you think? Do you think that's a good law that's going to help things move along more quickly? Or is that more just kind of a title? You know, it's going to have a title, but it's not going to have any effect.
No, I think there's reason to believe that's positive. I do still think it's kind of a thing of the past, but I do still think that there's some ignorance, for lack of a better term, out there that there's this, you know, 48-hour waiting period that actually really never has, or at least I shouldn't say never, it hasn't been in effect in a long time. But it is kind of tentatively and informally, I guess we'll say, in practice in some departments, but it never was, or at least recently was not a law. But yeah, the general public would think it was. If you ask someone, well, I have to wait a little bit. And I've definitely told people, no, if you have reason to believe that this is outside the norm of their behavior, you report it. You report it right away.
Bruce, you are the founder of Private Investigations for the Missing. And because of your personal tragedy, how can you describe how the families come to you and what their concerns are and what you actually do for them?
Well, we deliberately don't get involved in fresh cases for the reason Jordan just outlined. Law enforcement, in most cases, does a pretty good job initially. We get involved once the case has, I call it the redactive stage with law enforcement, is that they're just not actively pursuing the case, or it has become totally cold. So at that point, family members will contact us through the website and ask for help, and we'll kind of review the case and look at it, and if it's a case that we think we can do and we have the funding up for available for it, then we'll get an investigator, and we have case supervisors, and supervises a number of different investigators, and we get started on it. And what it does for the families initially is, you know, and having been in those shoes myself, there's a tremendous amount of satisfaction they get, and hope, and just in the fact that someone is out there looking and trying to do something rather than just no one. So, you know, that's a huge thing for families.
I would imagine, just to have to know something is moving in the right direction, and some effort is being made. Before we take a break, Bruce, and I'll ask Jordan this too, but Bruce, I'll start with you. How important is keeping the story in front of people, billboards and publicity, and reminding people this person's missing, last seen here, here's an age progression? How important is that to finding a missing person?
Bruce, go ahead.
I really don't think sometimes we've actually had billboards and things. Occasionally we'll get a tip or something from it. So, I mean, it could be well important. But in a general sense, the cases that we deal with, no.
And why is that?
Well, you get it's better to have an investigator on the ground doing the real work, the real research, actually looking to, interviewing people and doing the things that investigators do. The general public, a lot of times, just the public thing is actually a lot of negative stuff goes on. And you deal with people anywhere from psychics to absolutely crazy people to...
Yeah.
So a lot of leads that are going nowhere is what you're saying.
Yeah.
A lot of wasted time.
Investigators, right. That's gotten so much worse, and it's so... Yeah, I don't consider it... in the cases that we deal with, the little bit older cases, it probably does not. And initially, yes, I'm sure, within the first, few weeks or month or something.
Got it.
But
perfect answer.
No.
Yes.
Let's talk about rewards. How helpful, Jordan, do you think rewards are when they go out? I mean, I know in the Nancy Guthrie case, there was $1 million reward apparently out there. Does that really provoke people to tell you important information, or does it again create all kinds of false leads and bad leads?
Well, I think like most things, there's kind of a science to this. Actually, I haven't delved down it enough to expound on it in further degree. But essentially, there is kind of a sweet spot where this amount, and then don't raise it any higher, because once you go higher, you're only bringing the crazies out, like Bruce suggested. We've got plenty of cases where families are being harassed. There's a lot of that out there. So, that kind of goes back in step with what he was mentioning, that the putting the awareness out there, so to speak, is something that the public will, by and large, take care of on its own, believe it or not. I firmly do believe that there's a good, keep it present, keep it in the forefront. There is a benefit to having flyers out there, especially if a case is fresher, as opposed to some of the private investigations for the missing cases that are colder. But there is that sweet spot where if you're raising that for example, any case that we take on that is not through PIFTM, that we take on a missing persons case, that's the general rule of thumb that we offer our retainer as reward money. That's every single case we take. And I think that's kind of a practice that we go about to say, okay, this gives some incentive for authentic leads to come to the forefront, but we're not getting it out there where people are, where disingenuous, reward claimants are coming forward.
Bruce, and maybe I'll ask Jordan this question too. When you do solve a missing persons case, what are the top maybe few reasons it finally gets solved? Is it what puts it over the line and ends up in a positive identification or the person being returned to their family?
Go ahead,
Bruce.
The thing that often happens, we solve a number of cases that the person just leaves or separates from their family, and after a number of years, some family member wants to get in touch, and we've been actually pretty good at finding that person and at least notifying the family that, hey, the person is alive and out there, but just doesn't want any contact with them.
And how is that?
Go ahead. As far as the investigations is the actual investigation will sometimes find people. People are more naturally will talk to a private investigator. A lot of them have had like prior contacts with law enforcement or things like that. They're not willing to talk to anything, but a private investigator is not law enforcement. It's not going to be the one that arrests them. And you can also, you know, oftentimes information will come to a private investigator from someone, and that will end up leading to a self case.
And let's talk a little bit, Jordan, about social media and how it is used to find people.
Yeah, it's definitely, again, back to the traditional hard copy flyers being posted. It's similar. It's just a greater volume. You know, we're sharing it with other, because this is one topic where there is a lot of different pages out there on missing persons investigation, missing persons awareness, I should say, the caveat there. Bruce's organization is the only, as you said, that actually does the nonprofit side of it, investigations wise on the ground. But putting that volume out there, you're sharing it more. You're sharing with all these groups, so they're happy to share. They're happy to reshare it. It's happy to keep funneling that forward. The picture of the missing and their information with their flyer. We create an individual URL along with that one that's created by law enforcement. We create our own and do so likewise. Well, in one case, there's kind of a tool that we use called Link Analysis, and it's through a database network that we operate. And it essentially, one case I found someone through this Link Analysis where the victimology I mentioned, that set of interviewing didn't necessarily get me where I was going. I was getting some false leads about where this individual might be, but through the Link Analysis, I found someone. They led me to someone else. When I talked a little bit more to them, eventually they indicated that this individual was kind of strung out on heroin, right? Family didn't know anything about it. They gave me an indication where he might be, and that lead ended up recovering him. He was downtown, right in front of the water tower, actually, where they said he would be. So,
and is there, you know, if someone is working or someone using their social security, I mean, are these things that you can access to find them? You know, are they driving a car? Are they using a credit card? I mean, are these things that are easily readily available to you as a private investigator? Is that something that more that police can get quicker than you?
So you have to have justifiable usage for any time you're running. We have access to all of the above in these databases, but it's why are you searching it? What are the reasons why you're searching it? It's a kind of a legality, a tentative balance of legality and the efforts of putting forth in the investigation. You need to navigate that carefully. I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to instruct anyone on how they're doing it. I have a former non-practicing attorney who works for me, who advises me correctly on why we're searching and who we're searching and how we're going about that. But essentially, we also have partners in law enforcement who assist us. If we do, one individual was found through a combination, actually, of searching his credit card history, as well as where his internet usage, what we were able to find who his ISP internet service provider was through that, and through who he was paying through his credit card. So it's kind of a combination of both searches. We were able to successfully recover his whereabouts that way. So that's something though that gets into some definitely some slippery waters. Even in terms of DNA, Ancestry.com has some recent changes to their practices. This happened, I think, in December of this year, of 2025.
You mentioned, Jordan, DNA, and I guess I want to talk about that and how you, as a private investigator, maybe investigating a missing persons, how is DNA used?
So, generally speaking, it's not something that we're really going to be coming upon through an attorney, because there could be a conflict with possible obstruction of evidence or tampering with evidence or compromising the integrity of the investigation. You have to make sure that the chain of custody is followed through adherently. We do have labs that we've utilized, though, especially with and by and through an attorney. We've got two cases right now, for example. That's generally something that comes up more in wrongful conviction type cases. But in missing persons cases, we got a wrongful death case that we're going to be filing here soon, no body homicides. We got another one that also will be utilizing the attorney At some point, probably with DNA testing, but for the time being, it's going to be having to do with life insurance and bypassing HIPAA, some HIPAA restrictions.
So I guess what I'm asking is, how does DNA come into play in a missing persons case? I mean, when a missing persons case is investigated by the police, it is not always treated as a crime scene necessarily, right? Because we don't know if they're missing voluntarily, they're missing because someone abducted them. At what point does DNA become involved, and how does it become involved?
Right. I started to mention that with the restrictions with Ancestry.com, but there still is GEDmatch, which everyone knows by this point probably that it was.
No, I don't. Can you tell me what that is?
Sorry. Of course. Yeah, of course. It was used to find the Golden State Killer from the 70s.
Okay.
Yeah, it was used by matching a genealogy of a relative, linked it back to DNA that was left at one of the scenes. Okay. So that can still be utilized for missing persons cases as well. We have 4,400 unidentified bodies, you know, found every year. So through networks like the DOA Network, Name Us, the Charlie Project is a private entity as well. There's different ways that they can test. Is this DNA a link to a family member who ties back to an unidentified body? But through private labs, I would say Bruce has experience. Actually, he can touch on with using Authorm Labs. Who they're great. I need to speak a little bit on that. We personally have not gone down that road unless through an attorney.
Bruce, how have you used DNA, or how have your people that you're dealing with use DNA to find their missing loved ones?
Well, we came across Authorm Labs, which we use. We've had DNA in the past. A lot of states have their own DNA labs, and they're not as sophisticated. And I'm not an expert on DNA, but Authorm Labs can do incredible DNA, either reconstruction or how, being able to take it from minute particles, that sort of thing. And we have used them in cases. But
okay.
I've got an interesting case while we're on DNA, if you don't mind.
Sure, please.
Very, very quickly, we had a case in Florida. A young lady was listed as missing, and we signed an investigator to the case, and he had done quite a bit of homework and was, working on unidentified people. And he convinced the mother, who's the one that asked us for our help, he convinced the mother to actually go get a DNA test and accompanied her and, anything to allay her fears of, that sort of thing. And what happened was, she was a hit and run with no identification on her. And this is back, 30 years. But her DNA matched mom, so they actually had her body all those years and didn't know who it was.
Yeah, and, we're seeing that even with the John Gacy case. There are several unidentified remains from his house, and the sheriff here in Cook County has invited people to send in their DNA for their missing loved ones, and with the hopes that maybe they can be identified finally after all these possible years. Just really quickly, before I have to go for a break, I know you wanted to talk about the Ashanti Alert. We have Amber Alerts, which is for people under 18, and then we have Silver Alerts for seniors, and this is when people go missing or are believed to be abducted. What is an Ashanti Alert?
Yeah, so an Ashanti Alert is essentially a similar category for a missing at-risk adult. And it was passed for the namesake Ashanti Billy out of I believe it was Richmond, Virginia. And it's only active in a few states, and I can only deduce from my research that it's due to lack of funding that it's not active in Illinois, for example, with Chicago with a high population of missing and murdered females, frankly, compared to the national average. Not that this law is rendered just to females, by the way, but we actually are, number one, wanting to get this. We've been speaking with lawmakers at length, actually, about trying to get this in implementation. And I think it's only due to lack of funding that it isn't. It's just a way of prioritizing the investigation. If particularly, I would expound, although the bill is not linked specifically to black females, that black females in particular are at risk of domestic violence, missing and murdered, and the missing, which were previously unresolved, which are at a 6% differentiation of more likely become resolved after having been missing for an extended length of time. That's due to them being found as homicide victims.
Yes.
So because of that, because of the linkage between domestic violence, missing, and murdered females, we feel that there needs to be more prioritization put into searching for them when they first are signaled as being missing.
Makes sense.
There's a lot more that we can expound on. That's a research project all into its own, though.
Thank you. I'm going to thank you both for joining me. Jordan Scherer, he's with RA Private Investigation and Security, and Bruce Maitland, founder of Private Investigations for the Missing, a nonprofit. Thank you so much for joining us, and thanks for all the good work you're doing for all the people out there.